The Higher Education Committee will come to order. And the first thing on the agenda is to hear the governor's budget proposal. So we'd like to invite Matt Moening from the Department of Finance to join us. And we have a handout from the Finance Department. Good afternoon and welcome to the committee. You're new.
Good afternoon. I am, yes. Started in August. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Matthew Moening from the Minnesota Department of Finance. I believe you all received a copy of the one page of the governor's supplemental budget proposal that contains the higher ed recs. That's what I'm going to be going over today. First of all, overall, the governor's recommendations would amount to about a $52 million decrease in the state general fund appropriation for higher education. The proposals represent reductions of about $54 million in state general fund appropriations for FY 2009 for the two systems and for the Office of Higher Education, as well as a one-time appropriation to the University of Minnesota for a health-related study on the Iron Range. The proposed budget reduction for OHE is $111,000. This represents a 4% reduction to OHE's administrative budget. This is consistent with the proposal for most state agencies. The proposal does not spell out exactly how the Office of Higher Education would be to achieve these budget reductions. It allows some flexibility and allows the Office of Higher Education to figure out the best way to take those on. The proposed reductions for the two systems amount to 3.8% budget cuts for the total state general fund appropriations. For MinSCU, this amounts to about $26.6 million of the $689 million FY09 appropriation. One other way to look at this would be to look at the total operating budget, or sort of a rough estimate of the operating budget for MinSCU. That would look at the general fund appropriation plus tuition. That total amount is $1.3 billion, so this represents about a 2% cut to the total operating budget. For the University of Minnesota, the 3.85% cut equates to $27.2 million of the $705 million appropriation for 2009. Again, looking at the general fund appropriation plus tuition, this cut would equate to about a 2% cut. Finally, the governor's recommendation includes a $4.2 million appropriation to the University of Minnesota to conduct studies examining the high incidence of mesothelioma cases among Iron Range taconite workers. This is pretty much the high-level summary. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Moening. We're disappointed. Because we feel like we've been making some progress after the extreme cuts of 2003. We've been kind of crawling our way back to funding our higher ed systems. We've been trying to hold down tuition, and I just don't know what kind of an impact this is going to have now on the commitments that have been made to hold down tuition for the middle class. Any comments or questions from the committee? Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair. Mr. Moening?
Moening.
I'm only sorry that this is your first visit to our committee. But having said that, I couldn't agree with Chair Pappas more. I think that many of us felt pretty good at the end of last session. While we weren't able to do as much as we had hoped, we felt, perhaps for the first time in quite a while, that we were able to make some movement forward. And as I looked at these numbers when they came through, frankly, I feel as if we have been sent back to square one. And that is indeed unfortunate. And when we talk about the things that are of priority and that are important and what the real needs are in the state, you know, I think about our jobs numbers and I think about the state of our economy. And I think about capitalizing on the assets that we have in this state. And our people are our assets. And so I guess, Madam Chair, that I'm more than disappointed. Frankly, I feel like this is one area that we really could use some strong leadership in. And I don't think that we're seeing that in the budget proposal that's been presented. And, Madam Chair, if I could, I just one other further comment on the governor's budget, and that's regarding the taconite miners' health studies. And I want to be clear, I'm very supportive of that effort, but I am not convinced that this is the necessary revenue source for that work. And while I see officials from the university here, I think that it's worth noting in thanking the university for stepping forward to provide and offer some leadership in this area. And so I hope that that's an area that certainly will be funded, but I know that there are some alternative approaches that have been suggested.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any other questions or comments from Mr. Moning? We do have a number of people who are testifying. Members certainly can comment at any time during that testimony. Senator Sharon.
It's Mr. Moning.
Correct.
Welcome to the committee. I just was concerned about the way you bundled and discussed the cuts overall by bundling what the general fund appropriation was along with tuition, and then talking about this as though it's a 2% cut. I don't think that it's right to discuss what's happening here by bundling the students' tuitions into that. It gives a miscommunication, a mislead in terms of the seriousness of what is going to happen here to student tuition if we have to incorporate this kind of cuts to the university's budgets. So I think that that's a clever way of putting things together to try to make it a softer blow, but it really is, I think, disingenuous, so I can't support that kind of bundling in terms of discussing the impact this budget has.
Any other comments right now for Mr. Moning? Okay, thank you. We'll call you back if we have any questions. I hope you'll stick around.
All right.
Ms. Grimes from the Office of Higher Education, is Ms. Hegard unavailable, or you know more what's going on?
Madam Chair, for the record, Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. Yes, Susan Hegard is out of town today.
Okay. So you're going to give us an idea about what this impact, this $111,000 kind of impact on the agency and how you're going to handle that.
That's correct,
great,
Senator.
Thank you.
The Office of Higher Education Management Team is still working through the process of deciding how to manage the cuts. The agency is trying to balance external stakeholder needs, statutory requirements, and the capacity of the agency while avoiding cuts to areas that would directly involve service to students and student financial aid. The supplemental budget would reduce $111,000 of the agency's administrative budget, which is a 4% reduction. Director Susan Hegard asked me to say the $111,000 reductions will be difficult, but they are manageable, and they are not likely to result in the reductions of positions. However, if budget cuts were a larger amount, that probably would result in staff reductions. A rough estimate of areas likely to be affected is roughly $8,000 reduction in employee development for professional conferences and training, $4,000 reduction in agency memberships, $25,000 in printing, which would probably mean making more publications available online and eliminating some publications, $15,000 in computer technology and software, which would probably mean replacing hardware left less often and delaying the purchase of software upgrades, $25,000 from the accountability budget, which would probably mean one less survey to provide information on the effectiveness of Minnesota higher education, $5,000 in supplies and copying expenses, and $7,000 in travel within Minnesota and nationally. Without the $111,000, the agency will have less money for contingencies. The agency usually has some salary savings from employee turnover and contingency funds left at the end of each year that is used for severance for retiring employees and for special projects. In the past, the agency has used contingency funds for things such as upgrading our phone system to meet state agency standards, paying increased dues to the Midwest Higher Education Compact, more effectively providing online service to customers through new software and updating computer servers, remodeling to save on rent expenses by moving our outreach Get Ready Gear Up staff to the same place with our other offices, and providing funds to sign the state up for the e-transcript initiative, which enables high schools and their students to have low-cost electronic transcripts that can go to colleges and from college to college when students transfer. And one note of caution, the agency will also have to meet the 2008-09 biennium salary increases within the current budget. That concludes my...
It's a challenge. Ms. Grimes, I have just been given a copy of a letter that was sent to Ms. Hegard from Representative Rukavina about the ACHIEVE grants in the first year. Could you tell us a little bit about, he says that you are awarding $2.5 million ACHIEVE grants today, I guess. And I believe I had discussed this with Ms. Hegard, and it sounded like you were doing you're doing counseling services kind of across the state. Could you just tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, Madam Chair. In the ACHIEVE funding, it was $10.4 million altogether, of which $3.4 million was for 2008, listed under 2008, and $7 million for 2009. And $400,000 was slated in the money to go to the University of Minnesota and MinSCU to offer additional college in the schools kinds of programs. Of the three, and then $3 million was identified as providing a number of kinds of support services, whether it be for more college in the schools kinds of courses or other things that would help at-risk students understand that they should be taking the right courses in high school in order to be able to go on to post-secondary education. In discussing with various stakeholders, we decided that one of the real needs was for additional high school counseling and advising, particularly targeted to low-income students, students who were the first generation, first in their family to go to college, students of color, and other at-risk populations. And so we announced, we put out an RFP for a $2.5 million program of grants to school districts and schools, and we received 46 proposals, and we had planned to announce the recipients of the awards this week. At any rate, not necessarily today. Does that answer your question?
And are there a variety of things that you're giving grants to, or is it mostly for counseling services?
Madam Chair, we did put $200,000 of the money to increase our Intervention for College Attendance Program grants, which is a program we've had for some time. But the rest of the money, the $2.5 million, we put all into the counseling advising grants to high schools.
And Senator Wieger, of course, knows more than any of us how abysmal our proportion of counselors to students is. We're like last or 49th in the country in terms of the number of counselors we have available. So this is certainly a very important need. Wish that school districts would just hire them, but they're strapped for money, and that's always been a problem. So I think you've probably recognized a real need out there. I mean, students need to get this information about what courses they should be taking. Of course, I believe that all students in high school should be exposed to rigor and be prepared, therefore be better prepared for college. And we need to get that message out to them that the standard curriculum needs to be a college prep curriculum for all kids. That should be the default curriculum. And we have some school districts in the state, I think, that are leading the charge on that. Mm-hmm. South St. Paul has all IB, right? Mm-hmm. Senator Wieger, is it Fridley that has IB also? That's their default curriculum, or AP? So I forgot what school
there, but
it's AP there, right? Right. Any questions for Ms. Grimes? Okay, thank you very much. So we'll move on then, and we're delighted to have President Bob Brunix with us again, and of course Chancellor McCormick will be next with all his entourage that he's brought with him. President Brunix.
Madam Chair.
Senator Tomasoni.
Well, President Brunix is coming up. I just want to make a comment that the mess with the OMA study, I don't believe that the Air and Range Resources, which is the local property tax money, is the appropriate fund to do this. And I think I'll be in front of this committee probably next week with the mess with the OMA bill and what I think to be the proper funding source.
Okay.
Okay.
Great. Thank you. Welcome, President Brunix.
Thank you, Chair Pappas, members of the committee. It's great to be with you, although I wish it was on another topic. I'd like to begin by introducing members of our Board of Regents who have joined me today. Regent Patricia Simmons, who is directly in back of me, is the
Please raise your hand so we can all
chair
see
of the university's Board of Regents, David Metzen, past chair and member of the Board of Regents, Stephen Hunter. Linda Cohen, and Maureen Cisneros. And I want to thank them for joining us
here. That's a great turnout from the Board of Regents. Thank you all for coming.
Outstanding turnout.
Senator, excuse me, President Brunig, Senator Tomasoni.
Are they all retired? Is that why they're here?
They're all retired. They take their job as regent very seriously.
Occasionally I get to take the fifth, Senator Tomasoni. They are not. They work hard, and they get paid very well for it.
I know.
Serve pro bono. I want to begin by giving you a special thanks for your leadership on behalf of higher education during this last session. When I started as president of the University of Minnesota, my dowry was a 15%, $185 million cut within a month or two of accepting the responsibility. And I thought last year we made an extraordinary amount of progress in trying to restore the funding for public higher education in this state. I think it's one of the state's very, very best investments. For the University of Minnesota, that was approximately a 15% increase. Some people have cited a 17% increase, but that includes an economic development initiative that involves a partnership between Mayo Clinic and the University of Minnesota. During the period of time from 2001 to the present, the university's budget has increased about 2.5% a year. The state's budget has increased about 4.7%. And so I thought Senator Sharon's comment was really important. I don't think it's an accurate way to characterize the size and magnitude of this cut by combining it with tuition increases any more than it would be to combine it with other sources of revenue. I think one of the things I hope you'll take into account, and I'll come back to this point in just a few moments, and that is in the first year of the biennium, I think Minsky and the University of Minnesota received a rather substantial increase. It allowed the university to give a roughly 2% tuition scholarship to middle-income students and really restrain the increase in tuition quite substantially. In this next year, the state budget for the University of Minnesota goes up $16.6 million, that's the total amount of money we have to pay the bills in this second year. We've moved a little money from year one into year two, but not a substantial enough amount to really pay all the bills we have before us. I think one of the things I'd like to say is that higher education is one of the state's, I think, most important investments. If you want to grow jobs, grow Minnesota's economy, improve Minnesota's quality of life, I think this is one of the best ways to invest our funds for the future. But I do think we all face a responsibility and I think a challenge in keeping higher education accessible and affordable to young people and working adults in our society. We all need to do our part. I think higher education needs to watch the costs of higher education. That's one of our obligations. We need to go out and try to encourage private donors and people who have benefited from higher education to give something back, and we've clearly done that at the University of Minnesota. In the last couple of years, roughly 4 years, we've raised more than $200 million in private financing for scholarships and fellowships, and that's more than double the number of undergraduate scholarships across our campuses. In addition, we've tried to keep higher education accessible and affordable to low-income families by starting the University Free Tuition Scholarship Program for all Pell-eligible students. And next year, when fully implemented, this will provide free tuition and scholarship support for low-income students on University of Minnesota campuses. More than 4,200 students will take advantage of this program. And their average family incomes are roughly $25,000 a year. I think it's probably the most impressive program of its kind in the country. This has also been a university that has worked really hard to bring in new funding to leverage state investment. In the last 4 years, our University of Minnesota has brought in $110 million of new incremental funding. We estimate, using Department of Commerce statistics, that amount of money in 4 years has created about about 6,000 jobs in Minnesota's private economy and at the University of Minnesota. I mentioned the obligation to look at the bottom line and control costs. I think any reasonable review of the university's record in the last 6 years will show you that we have been very aggressive in this area. We've closed colleges, precipitating, in some cases, demonstrations on your mall and ours. We've restructured the University Extension Service. We've put in completely new computer enterprise systems that greatly improve the efficiency and the productivity of our services to students, to staff. We're putting in a new financial system. At one time, it used to take 6 weeks to get financial aid approved at the University of Minnesota. Now it takes a matter of a couple of hours. You can now register from South Africa or London, as well as the University of Minnesota campus online. These are just a few of the many things we could mention. Let me just say in closing that I'm not here to ask you to give the University of Minnesota a pass. I recognize we have a daunting challenge. It's close to $1 billion in revenue shortfall, and it doesn't look particularly good in the out years, according to the economists that I at least follow. So I'm not asking for a pass. I know you're going to have to send some responsibility our way. I hope you can make it a very small number. But I must tell you, $27 million on the heels of the budget reductions we've experienced, in my judgment, in the last few years, is simply too deep. That's close to 4% of the university's state budget. It's close to 4% of the state budget for Minsky. I think it's too deep. I think the opportunity costs for the University of Minnesota are too severe. It stops momentum. It more than likely at this level, $27 million would cause me to bring forward a recommendation to increase tuition at the University of Minnesota. I think I would have little choice. The choices are rather grim. If you try to solve this by just budget reductions, I estimate it would probably cost the University of Minnesota workforce about 400 jobs, and I think that's too severe a cut. Some people have suggested we use budget reserves. I don't think you budget long-term financing of a complex organization like the University of Minnesota with budget reserves. Those reserves can help you patch your way through on a short-term basis, but they are obviously not the kind of money you can use for long-term recurring investment. So my argument here is to do, to ask you to do everything possible to lower this recommendation to a level where we can avoid passing some of these costs on to students or the very talented staff of the University of Minnesota. I'd be happy to take your comments and questions at this time.
President Brunix, could you just comment on what the problem that's created here for you? So last year the legislature appropriated a 14% increase, and this is a 4% decrease. What if we had just appropriated a 10% increase last year? What's the difference?
Well, they're basically, you mean in terms of...
How you have to manage this.
Well, in managing this, we basically have three alternatives. We can cut costs. 70 cents of every dollar is tied to a person who works at the University of Minnesota. So when you talk about cutting the budget, you're cutting people. I think this is absolutely the wrong time to be cutting people and sending them out into this, what I consider to be a recession. Secondly, we have obligations to the employees. We've already negotiated of the university. We've already negotiated contracts. I went through asking our employees once to take a freeze. I'm not going to do it again in my tenure. It's asking too much, I think, of people who really work very hard on behalf of the University of Minnesota. To frame this just very briefly, we have $16.5 million of state funding for the second year of the biennium. The compensation costs of people who are on tuition and state money is $27.5 million alone. We have about $6 to $7 million of debt and operating costs, and that doesn't even begin to touch some of the necessary investments we need to do to keep the quality of the university up to where I think it needs to be to compete and to also best serve our students and our state. So it's very, very challenging when you put those numbers end to end. There's not a lot of There's not a lot of flexibility in the current budget. We barely have enough money to cover the anticipated costs in year two. The third thing you can do is obviously suspend or at least delay important investments. I think we're already underinvested in some very, very critical areas. It doesn't mean we can't do that. We're actually preparing scenarios now in which we would sharply curtail some investment next year. But if you totally disinvest, I can remember the 2003 to 2005 period when we couldn't invest in new hires, and we watched the grants and contracts of the university retreat and actually go down. To me, that's a recipe to lower the productivity of Minnesota's economy and erode its quality of life. So I don't think that's a very good trade-off either. So you have to keep the university competitive. We have to keep the quality of service to students, faculty, staff, and the broader community. It doesn't mean that we can't do our part, but I think given the history of reductions in higher education, I think this recommended reduction is disproportionately high.
Thank you. Senator Coring?
Madam Chair and President Brunix, disproportionately high, what do you think would be a fair number?
You want me to play my hand now?
Yeah.
I'm not prepared to give you a specific number at this point. I'd like it to be as low as possible, but certainly something significantly lower than 4%. I think to get a 4% cut at this time with the allocation we see in the second year is going to be very difficult to manage, and I suspect you're going to hear that again from my colleague Jim McCormick in a few moments.
And Senator Coring.
Madam Chair and President Brunix, I'm not trying to put you on the spot. It's just that I also, besides serving in this committee, I serve in Health and Human Services and Ag and Veterans Affairs. And, you know, we have people out there and a lot of my constituents calling that don't have health care coverage. And the Brainerd and Crosby school districts tried to pass a referendum, and they're having to make dramatic cuts. And so people are hurting across the spectrum. Right. And so I'm just trying to figure out, you know, I wish that we didn't have to cut anything. You know, it's easy to be a legislator when there's all kinds of money. You don't have to say no to anybody. But I'm just trying to figure out, you know, how do we find that delicate balance? And I don't know exactly what that is. But I appreciate your work, and I appreciate Chancellor McCormick's work. He even came up to St. Matthias, which is kind of way out in the sticks where I live, to have lunch with me. And so I appreciate your guys' work very much.
Well, Chair
President
Pappas,
Brunix.
Senator Coring, let me just put this. We have roughly $16.5 million of state funding next year, plus our tuition increase. $27.5 million of obligated compensation costs right off the top. The only way you can cut that is to cut people. And I'd prefer not to do that, to be honest with you. You cut people, you cut your institutional history, you cut your competitiveness, you cut the quality of service. I mean, I don't see people at the University of Minnesota just sitting around and not doing their jobs. They're working very, very hard. We have an obligation that we agreed to with the House and the Senate for a middle-income scholarship that costs $5.6 million next year. I'd like to keep that. You push this too hard, and I'm going to have to argue that you need to give us some relief there, because that's new money that we, at least $3 million of that is money that we had to come up with outside of the state budget. Facilities cost close to $6 million, and I haven't even started to take care of the usual things that happen, you know, the repairs that you need to address, spikes in utility costs. We manage utility costs to actually save money this year. I don't know whether we can do that next year, given the volatility of this marketplace. We have our fringe benefits factored in here, but there are a lot of unknowns when it comes to cost increases. You just have to look at food costs, for example, and say to yourself, what kind of impact is that going to have on people who get food services at the University of Minnesota? So there are just a lot of things that we have to manage here. I just hope you can get this down. I'm not here to ask you to give us a pass. I think that would be unfair, arrogant, under the circumstances. All of the examples you gave me are real needs in Minnesota, and I think we need to do our part. But I think it should be significantly less than this, and I hope you can find a way to make it so.
Senator Michelle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to hear a little more about Senator Coring's lunch, but I'll pass on that for now. Hopefully two quick questions for you, President Brunix. Number one, I'm sorry if you covered this before I got here, but I wanted to be clear on the university's, I guess, present commitment on tuition. As I recall, Minskew's talked about a cap on the tuition increase in the 1% or 2% neighborhood. And I thought I'd read that the university was actually above that, even up into a 5% or 6% range. And then I also heard that was only – it depended on income.
Yes.
Income level. So can you kind of give us – that'll be helpful as we go into this deliberation.
That's the banding thing I think you're talking about. President Brunix.
Yes, Chair Pappas, Senator Michelle, there are really two issues here. One is what Senator Pappas just referred to as tuition banding. Students, as a result of actions taken by our Board of Regents, now can take credits above 13 free on University of Minnesota campuses statewide. And we passed the statewide provision last year. If you stay on course to graduate, you can save roughly $20,000 to $25,000 and really lower your indebtedness. Dr. Zetterberg, who's here, has done some recent analysis, and there used to be this conventional wisdom that if students dropped out and they actually went back to work and then came back to school, they could reduce their indebtedness. That's not true. They actually increase their indebtedness if they drop out for any period of time. So that's one issue. The second issue is we entered into an agreement with the House and Senate to pilot an idea of providing a middle-class scholarship for families with incomes, adjusted gross incomes, up to around $150,000. So it's in the first year of the biennium, that allowed the University of Minnesota to lower tuition for low-income students to zero because of the free tuition scholarship, and for middle-income students to less than 3%. This next year, low-income students will have a zero increase in tuition, and that's roughly 4,200 students across the University of Minnesota system. And middle-income students would have a tuition increase of less than 5%. Now, students who are above, whose families are above that middle-income threshold would pay 7.5% next year.
President Brunix, for low-income students, though, you're talking about the Pell Grant eligible students?
Because
they don't
eligible.
Pay tuition at all.
Yeah, they pay no tuition right. or fees.
Yeah, yeah, so it's not like they don't have an increase.
No.
They don't have.
But all the increase is absorbed under yeah. the commitment.
Okay. And again, Madam Chair.
Senator Michelle.
President Brunix, so what's the number that separates the less than 5% from the 7.5% increase?
Where family incomes of more than $150,000 a year, okay. Which is a relatively small number at the university. Most people fall at or below $150,000.
Okay, so, and Madam Chair, so have not quite accurate newspaper reports or have others kind of jumbled all these numbers together and said, oh, the university's got a 6%.
7.5. They probably reported a 7.5% increase.
But that's not true.
that's not effectively true. If you take the low-income students on our campus plus the middle-income students, the actual increase is much less than that. I should also say that the number of students getting financial aid is increased very substantially through private sources. And we're feeling very good about that as well.
Thank you.
So we're doing a great deal to keep higher education accessible and affordable through our own efforts, through our tuition policies, and through, I think, some rather creative actions of the House and Senate last year to pilot this interesting program. I do believe, and I said this in a speech about 2 weeks ago, that the looming challenge we have in keeping higher education accessible and affordable is reaching the needs of middle-income families in our society, and that's an issue we need to take very seriously as we move forward.
Sure. Senator Tomasoni.
Madam Chair, we made some really good progress last year after several years of spiraling tuition increases that were basically because we were underfunding both of our college systems. And quite frankly, I'm really disappointed that they're under attack again. And I would hate to see us do something here where we have to raise tuition again, because these kids are graduating with mortgages, and they don't own a house. And they're going to be paying off their college loans when their kids start going to school. I mean, that's how bad it's been. And I'm happy to hear that you say that you don't want to see tuition go up. And I don't know if you should take a hit or not on this, but if you're willing to, I think the number you should come back to us with is the number where you don't have to increase tuition, because I think at some point in time we've got to start holding the line on tuition, because we have to make sure that we make college affordable for kids and that kids are going to school. And I know you're... Both systems are on board with that, and I know that we've got to be part of the solution.
Yep. Senator Pappas.
President Brunix.
Senator Tomasoni, we'd be more than willing to sit down with the committee and tell you where we think that threshold is, you know, where we think the reduction would precipitate some tuition increase or some modification in this middle-income program. But I think we should try this for 2 years. I think it's a very creative strategy. I think it lays the foundation for what might be a very promising strategy in the future.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you. Excuse my loss of voice. But the state of Minnesota has a budget reserve of about $650 million, and the governor is proposing to use $250 million to help with the deficit. And I am wondering what your budget reserves are and what percent of that you feel comfortable that you would be able to use to help fill a deficit that could be created by cuts to your funding.
President Brunix.
Chair Pappas, Senator Roebling, our budget reserves from all funds are roughly in that territory, but not all of those are fungible. They're budget reserves that are tied to projects that are in the pipeline where you have to pay debt and operating expenses. They're budget reserves that are tied to the hospital and clinical revenues of the University of Minnesota. They're budget reserves that that are tied to grants and contracts where you can't move the money from column A to column B. We're definitely going to have to cushion this impact, you know, by funding some of these transition costs. I would point out that we're going to be using some budget reserves. Just if you don't cut us a dime, we're going to be using some of those to keep the operating, the operating engine of the University of Minnesota moving forward. We constantly have to do that. We urge people to budget reserves so they can deal with the ups and downs of revenues that come from a variety of sources. 20% of the funding for the University of Minnesota, roughly 20 to 25%, depending on how you count, if you include state specials, comes from the state. We have to fund 75%. Those reserves are constantly in play, dealing with the ebbs and flows of revenues, and they are not completely fungible. They can be used. We will put them to good use in this transition. You cannot, for example, to move Professor Georg from the University of Kansas with her laboratory, one of the finest researchers in the world, you cannot use budget reserves to cover her core operational costs going forward. You can use them to fix her laboratory, and we do that all the time. We'll have probably several millions of dollars of reserves that will go into fixing laboratories, fixing special research facilities that we need to do on a regular basis. I'm not coming here to say we can't help solve the problem from that source, but in my judgment, that's not a way to pay for long-term costs. That's a very short-term emergency solution. All you do is pass the cost on to future budget years and create a bigger problem downstream. I don't think that's the way to run the University of Minnesota, and we have not tried to budget ourselves in that way.
But, Madam Chair?
Senator Roebling.
But in a lot of ways, that's what you have budget reserves for. I mean, that's what we're going to have to use ours for, too. And it's not a preferred method because you'd like to leave them intact, but that's what they're there for. So when things get really rough, and they are, that's what we have to turn to as well.
Well, I will just simply argue that we will turn to those as a source of support for funding the ongoing costs of the University of Minnesota that are significantly above the state budgeted allocation to the University of Minnesota, and we'll use some of that to help us through the transition. But I think we need to look at this situation not just in terms of the state's budget this year and what its impact is on the university. We should take maybe a 5 to 6, 7 year look, and keep in mind that the state's commitment to the University of Minnesota, including the extraordinary year last year, is 2.5% a year. You take last year out of the equation, and it's pretty close to negative in the last 6 to 7 to 8 years, and I can assure you during that period of time, the costs of the University of Minnesota have not been zero to negative. They've been going up at roughly 4.5 to 5% a year, even with strong fiscal management. And during this period of time, I would point out, the university has leveraged every dime of state support on a very, very with a very, very high rate of return. Show me some places in the state that have brought in $110 million in the last in the last 4 years, created by the formulas we have from the Department of Commerce, 6,000 jobs in the private economy, and at the University of Minnesota, three-quarters of those have been in the private economy. Last year, we generated 2,000 jobs in the entire state of Minnesota. The grants and contracts of the University of Minnesota went up nearly $50 million and created close to 2,000 jobs. So, you know, you can argue this a lot of different ways, but I'm saying that a serious cut, a cut of this magnitude, is a decision to disinvest, to make us less competitive, to lower the quality, and to put upward pressure on prices. And if it doesn't do that, and if you use short-term fixes, you're likely not to have a very strong university in the future. And quite honestly, I think we need to fight for a stronger university, a stronger higher education in Minnesota. That's what's going to carry us, I think, to the next level in the world economy.
Thank you very much, President Brunix. We appreciate you taking the time to come and talk to us. Give us your response to the governor's budget, and thank all the members of the Board of Regents also for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chancellor McCormick.
Thank you. All the way to St. Matthias.
Good afternoon. I'm Jim McCormick and have the privilege of serving as Chancellor of the Minnesota State College and University System. The board and I appreciate so much your having this hearing to discuss the challenges and to be concerned about our students, and I just we appreciate it. I want you to know that our board, as you know, has been very supportive, and usually one or two or three members join me on these occasions, but we're in board meetings today and tomorrow. So they're already working on behalf of the people of Minnesota. I also want to acknowledge that we have a visiting group here, from the Northeast Higher Education District. That includes Hibbing and Mesabi and Grand Rapids and Ely and International Falls. I hope I didn't miss anybody. And they're here on a leadership training time, and welcome. And we have student leaders here, and two of our associates representing the faculty bargaining units are here. So,
well, great. So, welcome to all of you.
So thank you. We educate, and I know you know this, but I want to put it in perspective. We educate more than 382,000 students each year in credit and non-credit courses. We're about 64% of all Minnesota undergraduates. Each year, we graduate more than 33,000 students, and more than 80% of our graduates stay in Minnesota to work or continue their education. But thank you for the opportunity. We know that, and I've sensed it as I've been listening, we know that you have a difficult problem to solve. But we believe the proposed cuts to higher education are too deep, and I couldn't be more supportive of my colleague Bob Brunix on this same issue. I will start by reviewing the pertinent facts of our financial history. Historically, state appropriations have covered more than two-thirds of the cost of the student's education, and the tuition has paid about a third in Minnesota. That began changing in 2003 when our budget was cut by $47.6 million. To get to where we are today, I just need to do a little bit of background over these years. Now, during the next 2 years, and President Brunig's talked about some of this as well for the university, but during the next 2 years, our budget was cut by an additional $191 million for a total of $240 million. Now, this led to, and by the way, that was a difficult period for the nation, a difficult time for Minnesota. We tried to make that work. But this led to several years of double-digit tuition increases. And we were unable to work on many critical initiatives. Now, last year, and I want to thank you for this, last year the governor and the legislature gave us an increase of about $150 million. With this appropriation, we finally got back to the amount of state appropriations that we had before the cuts. Today, we are only $20 million ahead of where we were in 2003. A cut of $26 million will put us back into that hole. Now, you've been asking questions about consequences. We believe, and I've had conversations with almost every one of you, we believe that you provided the appropriation increase with the expectation that we would keep tuition increases low, provide higher salaries to recruit and retain high-quality faculty, and expand programs of services for the underrepresented students. You also saw the need for us to renovate an aging system-wide technology network long past its useful life. Now, this morning, the board's finance committee, and it's just so interesting these are the same day, the board's finance committee delayed adopting the fiscal 2009 budget until after the legislative session, until after this is resolved. The budget proposed that was already out in our materials that was proposed to the board would have limited tuition increases to 2% for the two-year colleges and 3% for the state universities. This budget included salary increases that recently were negotiated and provided services to recruit and retain more underserved students. The proposed budget cuts put all of this progress at risk and prompted the committee to delay adopting the fiscal year 09 budget at this time. Now, 1 year ago, if we had known this budget reduction were coming, we would not have proposed such low tuition increases, nor taken the steps we have on our salary negotiations, which were needed very badly. If these cuts are implemented, it seems to me we have three choices. We can, number one, roll back new investments. This would slow down such critical initiatives as better preparing the workforce that you helped us with. We could ask the system to absorb a 4% base reduction, which would mean fewer program offerings, fewer new programs, and fewer advising and counseling services. This could result in approximately 450 people being laid off at a time when our colleges and universities are at record enrollment levels and the state economy is declining. Or we could increase tuition. This would require, if we went that way, and the board does not want to do that. They've been very committed to trying to get the tuition down, and we sense that from you. But if we did go to tuition, this would require a 4% per year additional increase in tuition to replace the $26.6 million, or 4% on top of 3 and 4% on top of 2. Now, none of these choices is attractive to us, nor I'm sure they're not attractive to you either. At our board meeting this week, and we're in session through tomorrow, we will start the discussion about actions to balance the budget if these cuts are implemented. There's no way for us to remove that much money from the budget without a serious impact on students, on faculty, and on strategic initiatives that include providing the educated workforce that Minnesota needs. Now, last year, and I want to put this in perspective too, last year we asked for $180 million increase for the biennium to cover anticipated inflation of $57 million and the other critical investments. You supported us, and we thank you for that, with a $150 million increase. Keep in mind, this $1.6 million cut continues in future years. Over 2 years, it would amount to a cut of more than $50 million. We would not have proposed, I'm quite sure, we would not have proposed such a low tuition increase nor taken the steps we took on salary negotiations if we had known that these budget cuts were coming. So I thank you for your time, your consideration, and I what I really believe is a sincere demonstrated support for our students and public higher education. And again, the board and I, the trustees and I, appreciate your attention to call the hearing and to give us an opportunity to talk with you about the impact of these cuts. Thank you.
Chancellor, how many years have you been in Minnesota now?
This is seven.
7 years.
And they've been, I share with President Brunings. I think he was named president 1 year later. They have been difficult, but we were so pleased
difficult
with
years,
the
right.
direction we were going this last year. I think we made great progress.
And you came from Pennsylvania, right?
Yes.
What's been happening with the higher ed system in Pennsylvania?
Well, you know, I've been working so hard in Minnesota, I hardly know. And but I haven't paid a great deal of attention. But I do want to put things in perspective, though. The challenges we had in 2003, particularly, were challenges that the whole country faced. Mm-hmm. And the other higher education systems are facing some of these challenges, too. But I thought it was so important, so pleased with last year, because I believed that we were coming back to the kind of investment that we need to make. And I just think, and I won't go on with this, but I just think our future is in our people. And this investment in the people of Minnesota will be the thing that makes us globally competitive and keeps our economic vitality and the quality of life, which is so important here. And so, you know, I have a real passion, and I'm sure Dr. Brunning says too, about this investment. And I feel that it's my job on behalf of the board, and I don't want to be insensitive to all these other needs that I'm sure you're facing, but I think it's my responsibility to be the advocates of our students and of the state in terms of this investment. So that's why I come to you today with a great concern about the possibility of cuts.
Okay. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chancellor McCormick, I just want to ask you the same question I asked President Brunix about budget reserves, what your current reserves are and how they might be helpful in helping on a short-term basis resolve this latest budget deficit.
By the way, I have been blessed with great staff at the Office of the Chancellor, and I want you to know we have real depth, and Laura King is an outstanding chief fiscal officer. And when you asked that question, I indicated I'd ask her to come. But I do want to say, I thought Dr. Brunings gave a good answer about this, too, but I do want to give Laura a chance. She's right on top of that exactly. And Laura, why don't you answer for us?
Ms. King.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Senator Roebling. We have a policy, a board policy, that directs the campuses to budget reserves in the 5 to 7% of their general fund revenues as a target. And it has taken us about 7 years to get to a position now where overall we're at 5%. At the time of the merger and then through those years at the early 2000s, we had reserves down in the 1 and 2% range overall. We now have overall, on average, reserves at the colleges and universities of about 5%. It ranges from a low of 2%, and the high, I don't know what the high is. The high is over 5. I don't recall exactly. I completely concur with President Brunick's remarks. We use those reserves when we have an emergency event. We don't have recourse to the state general fund, to the Department of Finance, if a roof blows off, or if we have flooding, or if we have a boiler fail, or if we have a surge in enrollment. That's what we use those reserves for. The concern I have about looking at them as part of a package this year is 2010 and 2011 are just as negative as 2009 and actually more negative. And so we're very concerned that we would sort of play all the cards we have this year and then be faced with an even larger reduction in the coming biennium. So I don't think we're going to use them as a significant part. We have campuses that have different impacts coming their way because of the way their budget works, and I would expect on a campus-by-campus basis that they may be looking to reserves as a bridge strategy to get them to a new base budget. But it's not likely that we'll be recommending to the board as a general strategy that reserves be used as part of a budget reduction.
Laura, this first time, Madam Chair, this is the first time I think that we have talked about reserves, but we have lots of auditors looking over our operations, and there's great pressure, and you may say a word about this, that our reserves are not enough. Because the question is, if you had a meltdown, how many weeks could you operate?
Right.
And so we're pressured, the board, all of the time to have bigger reserves.
That's
and,
right.
And this is an interesting phenomenon. And there's also an appetite to use the reserves. I mean, there's a tension between the mm-hmm. two. But maybe just a word about
certainly.
That, Madam Chair.
We have, since 2002, we have had three different groups of auditors annually performing financial statement audits for us. We have our 12 largest institutions audited by outside CPA firms, and then we have the whole system audited by a different outside CPA firm. We have installed very aggressive expectations around financial management and financial discipline, and this audit discipline has been very helpful to that. The audits come out well. Campuses are doing a terrific job, and the auditors have told us every year from the beginning that we are under-reserved by every national standard available to them. Because we are expected to run our own operation, we are running a $2 billion a year operation located in 100 places around Minnesota. The schools are expected to raise revenue and manage their expenses so that they balance. And the reserve levels are considered by national measures to be sort of scary low in that environment. It's more typical for organizations like ours to have reserves of about 30% to 35% of revenues, and we are operating on a system-wide average of 5%. It's quite a difference, it goes really to the culture here. Our system is viewed sort of half being like a state agency and half being like a separate organization. And so we get pressure, as the Chancellor said, we get pressure from both directions.
Any other questions for now? Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry I missed much of the presentation earlier. I was presenting bills in other committees. If you already covered this, I apologize. But can you... the governor anticipates that you'll take the cuts out of your administrative costs. Can you say a word or two about what kind of steps you've taken in the last several years to try to reduce your administrative costs or create more efficiencies in the governance of the system?
Certainly. I'd be happy to, Ms. Madam King. Chair and Senator Latz. For those that don't have the materials in front, the governor's remarks suggested that we look to administrative costs and operating efficiencies before we impact our strategic initiatives or before we impact tuition. I would assure you that we look every day, every year, at our operating efficiencies. We just recently completed a study and find that we are 44th in the country on spending for non-instructional purposes. Everything from the executive costs to institutional support to staff in counseling and advising, we are, if not the lowest in the country in spending in that area already, we're close to the bottom. One of the reasons why we were so delighted with your support for the technology initiative last year is that that's one of the strategies we have for delivering operating efficiency to the whole system. I was struck recently with an article I read that the University of California State University System, which is 27 universities and about 400,000 students, so all baccalaureate but the same kind of sort of volume and scale operation, is just completing a $420 million technology project to bring to those institutions what we already have in terms of operating benefits. We are way ahead of most of the systems in the country using technology, and that has enabled us to operate much, much less costly operations than other systems do. We have shared registration, shared banking, shared payroll, and that's why we can run as the 44th most expensive system administrative costs in the country. So technology has been a very important strategy for us. Staff training has been a very important strategy for us. Looking at where we are from a real estate standpoint, how we are organized with our technology staff, we have changed all of that to consolidate some operations and avoid duplicate equipment costs. So I would offer that to you as a sort of a quick answer.
I think, though, it's fair, Madam Chair, and Senator Lass, I think it's fair, though, as I want to come here today as an advocate for not having cuts because I think we've taken them over the years. But I also want to be a good Minnesota citizen, too, as Dr. Brunig suggested. And when the final decisions are made, I assure you that our appropriate committees of the board and staff will look over everything to figure out how to do this. And there's a great hope that the tuition issue, that we can make some headway on that one, because that's been a serious problem of earlier cuts. Those were related.
Okay. Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Chancellor and Vice Chancellor, obviously one of the purposes of consolidating the systems was to try to create those kind of efficiencies that can be dealt with system-wide. Are there any particular, besides the technology initiative, are there any other particular efforts you've made to try to consolidate, like bulk purchasing or anything like that you've been focusing on?
We've had
Chancellor,
Senator Latt, Madam Chair, and Senator Latt. We've had a number of initiatives. I think we're the 11th year into this now, and one of the things, and maybe everybody doesn't agree, but we've gone from 45 presidents to 32. We've had a lot of particularly in the more unpopulated areas. We found way to bring campuses together under leadership so that they can share and so on. I think we've got some efficiencies there. I think we also have had three chancellors, three boards, and three offices, and we've been able to bring that together. A lot of what we do in the central office, and I think well more than half, is in the area of shared services. And there are case after case where, for instance, on the collection of student loans, instead of having 32 people do this, we have
three and a half
people doing it for the whole system. A number of cases with technology where we've found the efficiencies to do that. But we've also been asked to do more at the same time in terms of accountability, in terms of dashboard measures. There's been a lot of change along the way in terms of new things, new accountability, new transparencies, and so on that are expected at the same time. So I would say, we haven't really done those comparisons, but my sense is that these shared services are quite effective. One of our university presidents said publicly that if he had to do the kind of support that our technology initiative would do individually, it would cost him to two or three times as much. So I think we're able to realize some economies of scale as a result of being a central system. And we might need to give you some more additional information on that.
Well, Laura? Just to Senator Latz, to your question about purchasing particularly, we have an effort led out of our office that's providing statewide group purchasing leadership to the system. We just recently went through an RFP process and brought all the metro schools into one banking relationship instead of having 11 or 12 different banking relationships. And that saves them. The most recent report I got was something in the $110,000 a month range over their prior agreements. We're working now with about 8 schools on the subject of motor pools. And can we do group purchasing for motor pools? We've provided leadership to the whole Midwest Higher Education District, Midwest Higher Education Compact Region, which is 11 states around.
South Dakota just came in, 12.
12 states.
South Dakota just came in? Oh, great.
And Senator Pappas has seen these reports. Our folks have led negotiations on a Microsoft contract that has saved the upper Midwest region tens of millions of dollars by doing a bulk purchase on Microsoft licenses. So we are in that part of this, and we're making big strides.
And there's some other initiatives that, Madam Chair and Senator Lass, some other initiatives that go on all the time. And this doesn't make always campuses or colleges happy. But, for instance, we've decided that we're going to have three law enforcement centers. There's one in Hibbing, one in Alexandria, and there'll be one at MCTC that will actually be on the Hennepin campus. Now, those are decisions about not having 21 of those, but having three because they're very intensive costs in terms of indoor facilities and so on to make those things work. And so all of the time those questions are being asked. We just don't adopt a new program at one of the campuses till the others have a chance to think about it. We ask the question, do we need it? And we've tried to manage our resources and eliminate duplicate programs and those things because we have those kinds of program reviews that go on. I would like to think that we do a great job for you, the staff does and the presidents, on our capital budget, where instead of everybody coming in with whatever they think they need, we try to have a very coordinated purpose. How do they work together? Is there a need? And we don't duplicate what we need. We're trying to work on all of those things. So I think your capital budget, and I think we've been complimented for that, does reflect some good central management with presidents participating. And by the way, just the last point that I want to make, my style of leading a system is not to have the central office make all of the decisions. We've established what I call the Leadership Council. That's made up of the 32 presidents and the four senior officers of the system. And so much of what we recommend to our board and work on has the presidents involved in that process in a very significant way. Thank you. I'm going too long. I'm sorry.
Thank you very much, Chancellor. Ms. King, we appreciate you coming and being here with us today. And we have some...
Thank you so much.
Thank you. We have some students and some faculty groups that would like to testify, and I guess we're kind of running a little late. We have two major issues to take up yet, so I'd like to ask you all to come up and try to be fairly brief. Why don't I bring you up in teams, MSA, Mark Nagel, Ross, Scadam, Emma Olson. The three of you could come up. The state universities, maybe Mr. Stanton, do you want to join them? Where is he? Why don't you join them? This is the right group for you, right? Just grab another chair. What?
You want the faculty with the students?
I can't hear you.
Do you want the faculty with the students, or do you want the faculty separate?
Well, why don't you join the students this time, Rob?
Okay.
Because usually we have the faculty separate. I thought I'd do it differently. Okay, welcome to the committee. And
hi.
Once again, I'd just like to ask you to be brief.
Thank you for hearing testimony today. I really thank the chairman or the chairwoman and the committee members. My name is Emma Olson, and I'm the undergraduate student body president here at the university.
Great.
And I'm also a junior in political science and business.
At which university?
The University of Minnesota, Twin Cities. That's MSA is our student government.
Oh, you know, I'm sorry. I was thinking MSUSA, so you're University of Minnesota students.
Yep.
I'm sorry, Russ. You can step back. Okay, I got it. We don't see you so much, so it's great to have you here.
Well, thank you.
Come more often.
Yeah, that's our plan.
Good.
So as my time at the university, I've had the opportunity to see how many things the university really does for students. Students have opportunities to work with internships. They participate in student groups from student government to the genetics club. I mean, there are just so many opportunities. There are research programs for both graduate and undergraduate students. And they also have different opportunities within rec sports and athletics. Reducing the budget for the university would really increase the cost of education or of attendance here, and thus affecting students adversely, and then also reducing the quality of education. And we just really hope that you will do everything you can to stop that. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Olson. Next.
Hello. I'm Dustin Norman. I'm actually in for Ross. He couldn't attend today.
Okay. Your name is Dustin?
Dustin Norman.
Norman?
I am the president of all the fraternities at the University of Minnesota.
So, great.
And I just want to take a minute to have your time, and thank you, Chairwoman and Senators, for this, to really speak about my university, which I really do love. I love my university so much. It's just hard. You know, every single year when I hear about tuition increases, I hear about what's going to happen to the students who are coming in as I'm in my fourth year, and I think about for freshmen who are going to be shackled with tuition increases every single year that they want to go to school. You know, right now my mind belongs to the University of Minnesota, but my wallet belongs to the U.S. Bank. Mm-hmm. You know, like as I go through each day, I have to think about once I graduate, I have 6 months to find a job. I have no adjustment. I can't like think about, oh, I would like to go off and do this, or I would like to take my time and all the knowledge that I have in trying to travel. I have to find a job and I have to go out and do exactly what I'm supposed to do because that's what my university asks of me right away. And I do want to go to law school, but I can think about what that's going to be, $30,000 a year on top of the loans that I already have out. It's going to be, I'll be paying until I'm 40. And I can accept that as I'm 21 years old because I understand the opportunities ahead of me will be great. But I feel less fortunate each day that I get closer to graduation because I think about what the burden is on me and for the students who are going to be coming into my university. So I just want you to think about that from the student aspect. I mean, it is difficult when you're in class and you think about how much a credit costs. You think about how much your tuition costs. And in 4 years, it's difficult to graduate in 4 years when they're saying to you, we want you to study abroad. We want you to take internships that don't provide money. We want you to study languages. You know, that's not easy. These are things that we need because we need to be well-versed in the world so we can care for the people who are older than us. But at the end of the day, it's so difficult for us to really understand exactly what it means to be a student unless we can get the full concept. And if we're worried about nickels and dimes, we're really not worried about the words on the page. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Norman. Appreciate your comments. Next.
Afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Mark Nagel. I am chairman of MSA, and I'm here today to talk to you about Minnesota's commitment to higher education. I think that as a leader, as a state leader, Minnesota needs to consider its investment in higher education, and that this is a long-term solution to, I see it as a long-term solution to the current recession. Minnesota needs to think of its role in investing in people, and I think that by investing in the university, you are investing in people.
Great. Thank you. Today. And who else has joined us?
I'm Jordan. Excuse me, Jordan Bronston. I'm a student at the U of M.
Jordan, what was your last name?
Bronston.
Bronston. Yep. Okay, thank you.
So, just like you, thank you, Chair Pappas, for having me here today. I've been a student, a junior, major in economics at the U of M, and the past 3 years have been great. Just a broad range of activities and things that you can do there. My older brother also attended the University of Minnesota. And my younger brother next year is going to be attending the U of M. My sister attended Madison, so we don't know. But
Madison?
Yeah, Madison. But so we have a long line of family that comes to the University of Minnesota because it has, I think the state of Minnesota even just has such a strong stand in education. You know, even when you look across nationwide, I mean, we're renowned for that. And to see that tuition might go up or increase, and you know it's bound to happen just because that's the way the economy works. But because of the what's going on currently with the budget, kind of saddens me because I would just like to see a lot of people who have been in my position or with family members who have patronage towards the University of Minnesota. I would like to see these not to have a burden on their decision to attend such a great school. So that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for joining us today. Kara Brockett from MSUSA. That's the state colleges.
Madam Chair.
And
Madam Chair, if yes? It's all right, staff member from MSCSA is welcome to join.
He's going to come too? Okay.
Our comments are aligned.
So. Great. That's fine. Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, while they're getting seated, I just wanted to thank the students for coming forward today, and you are right to question Minnesota's commitment to higher ed. And that's kind of a hard thing for me to say as a member of this committee. But the students are right. When the budget before us has 20% of the budget cuts fall under the umbrella of higher ed, you are absolutely right to question that. And please continue to do so.
Good afternoon, Chair Pappas and committee members. For the record, my name is Scott Formal, President of the Minnesota State College Student Association. I'm here today along with Kara Brockett with the Minnesota State University Student Association and to strongly encourage you to defend your diligent work from last session and contest the governor's budget recommendations for higher education, which is exactly where today's discussions have been at, and I thank you for doing that. From the very beginning of this current legislature's term, you heard the many struggles that students and other stakeholder groups face in the higher education realm. As an association, we recognize the work that this committee did last session and believe that the recommendations made by the governor take the state in the wrong direction during this time of economic change. While last session's omnibus bill provided the single largest increase to Minnesota State College and University system in history, as Chancellor McCormick pointed out earlier, we still have a long way to go before we fully recover from the reductions felt in higher education in the previous budgets. Furthermore, there are several new initiatives that you could not fund last year, such as science, technology, engineering, and math programs, or the STEM programs, additional funding to get the state back on track with its long-time commitment and policy to providing 67% of the cost to higher education. Unfortunately, as you've heard many times, students are now facing the burden of making up the state's budget deficit by funding approximately 50% of the cost of higher education themselves. The governor's recommendations that are being discussed here today balance the state's budget deficit, but also hold the K-12 system harmless. We believe that it should also hold Minnesota's higher educational system harmless. It's equally important to ensure that continuing educational opportunities exist for high school graduates and returning adults to provide a stable workforce for the state. In fact, in times of economic downturn, having an affordable and accessible community and technical college system is even more crucial as many workers come back to these institutions to receive further training or job skills. Last session, Minsky was allocated an approximately $157 million increase in funding. The governor's recommended cut of approximately $26.6 million relates to around 50% or a $54 million cut to Minsky-based funding into the next biennium, 35% of the entire increase to the system from what was appropriated last year, or what was increased last year. Cuts to the public higher education during fiscal year 2009 seems to be a repeat of what happened in 2003, a trend that we believe follows a dangerous precedent and would be a major step back from the good work that was done last session. As Chancellor McCormick pointed out earlier, this again is forcing Minsky to look at a potential 6-7% increase in tuition at a time when we have all worked hard to keep that minimal. While we certainly recognize the challenge that this legislature faces in balancing a significant budget shortfall, we believe furthering the trend of reducing public higher education budgets will only exacerbate the drastically increased costs of higher education. We certainly understand that any specific areas of the state's budget can be targeted by the legislature to reduce spending, but we would also recommend that you look first to alternative options in lieu of simply cutting higher education budgets, specifically those of Minsky and the University of Minnesota, to balance the state's deficit, forcing higher educational shortfalls to fall on the backs of students once again. More specifically, the students of MSCSA encourage you to, one, be creative and find alternative ways to avoid cuts to education, holding Minnesota's entire public educational system harmless, including higher education. Two, explore ways that the state financial aid system may be able to better utilize surplus money that has already been realized to specifically help students in the public system that may now again be facing tuition increases because of pending cuts to the system. And three, any reductions to the Minsky base budget, we would ask that you look to make that a priority in the future to be replaced with any new state dollars and adjusted for inflation as soon as possible once the state budget outlook improves. Immediate replacement of these funds will allow the system to maintain the quality offerings and could allow the system to temporarily shackle students with another round of tuition increases. I want to stress that we understand that the state's budget needs to be balanced, and we also believe that you as lawmakers have the ability, motivation, and expertise to balance the budget while holding the state's public educational systems harmless, from early childhood all the way through higher education, beginning right here with the work of this committee. At the very least, you have the ability to minimize these impacts on not only programs and services, but also on the student's pocketbook looking into the future. Again, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to address you here today on behalf of Minnesota's technical and community college students, and I would stand for any questions.
My name is Kara Brackett. I'm the state chair of the Minnesota State University Student Association. I'll keep my comments brief as our association aligns with MSCSA on their stances as to what to do. Though it may be difficult, we strongly urge both this committee and the House committee to do everything possible to eliminate these cuts to higher ed. We have passed out a letter from the Coalition of Minsky Students and Faculty for all committee members. This really addresses how we feel that in the past these budget cuts have been made up through tuition increases, and the result of that has been significant debt for our students. Many of you would have seen our tuition debt campaign that we did last year and the debt stories that we collected from our students, and these are crippling burdens that our students are going to have to graduate with 30, 40, even the students with only $20,000 of debt, that's a significant barrier to what they're going to be able to do as soon as they graduate college. And though I doubt the probability that any cuts to the Minsky system will be resulted in tuition increases, the current proposed cut would result in a 4% tuition increase if we were looking to maintain the funding level that Minsky is currently at right now. And that is of deep concern to our student association when we look at the cuts that we've experienced in the past and how those were made up with tuition increases. So I urge you to look through our letter and really keep in mind that tuition has already placed a major burden on students, and that we need a break is what it comes down to. So I'm open for any questions.
Great. Thank you both very much for coming today. I appreciate it. Okay, then we have Rick Nelson and Greg Mulcahy from NSCF and Russ Stanton from IFO. Would you come up together? Rick, you're by yourself?
Yes.
Okay. Not Greg. Okay, welcome, and hopefully I have to ask you to be brief.
Okay,
running behind.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Russ Stanton. I represent the Interfaculty Organization, State University faculty. We would urge you to oppose the Governor Pawlenty's plan to permanently cut the funding base for MinSCU by $26.6 million per year. First of all, the proposed cuts are disproportionate for higher education. I passed out a printout from the Department of Finance webpage, which shows the spread of the cuts by area. And on the back side, it has a pie chart showing the percent of money spent in each area of the budget. And if you look at that pie chart, higher education makes up 9.1% of the budget. Of state spending from the general fund. But if you look at the spending cuts, particularly in the out years, in the 2010-2011, higher education is expected to take over 20% of the cuts in the governor's proposed budget. And we think that that's disproportionate, and that the cut should be more fairly spread across all areas of the budget. Secondly, the last rounds of cut, this comes on top of very disproportionate cuts the last time we had a budget cut. The last time we had a budget cut, starting in fiscal 03, we first had a $20 million cut to MinSCU, followed by a $25 million rescission, followed by a $161 million cut to the MinSCU budget, and for the 04-05 biennium, that was equal to 16% of the total spending back then, and we're just starting to recover. Last biennium, our last session, you did a great job of providing us with a good deal of money. We have been able to hold down tuition increases, which had been averaging around 11% a year for the previous 4 years. We were able to get them down to 3 to 4% this year. And for next year, the system was planning on getting those down to 2 to 3%. It made a big difference. Faculty salaries, which were slipping in competitiveness for a long, long time, we were able to get a decent contract, we feel. And we may even get up to the national average for peer institutions. So, it was good. We also, third, we think that there's alternatives to cutting higher education. If you look at the governor's budget plan, first of all, what we would say is we shouldn't be cutting the sales tax by 0.125% at this time. That exacerbates the budget problem or the gap by $77 million this year, $178 million next year. This isn't the time to do that. Secondly, we would agree with the governor that his proposal to conform the federal definition for income on foreign corporate operations, that would raise $102 million this year and $164 million next year. Another thing that we think could be done is the I-35W Victims Compensation Fund. The proposal is to take it half from the general, and the governor's plan is to take half from the general fund, half from the transportation fund. With the passage of the gas tax, I think the transportation fund is in a lot better shape. You could probably save $20 million from the general fund by having that come from the transportation fund. And finally, we would urge you to protect the core of our operations when you're doing budget cuts, and to make your cuts specific. And by the core, we mean the campus level budgets. You appropriated a 10.6% appropriation increase to Minsku this past for this biennium, for this year. The increase to the campuses was only 3.5% by the allocation formula. The campuses were the ones who took the biggest hit the last time, and if you look, the allocation next year for the campuses by the Minsku allocation formula, the appropriations actually reaching the campuses by that formula are less in 2009 than they were in 2003, despite inflation, despite enrollment growth. So we would urge you to direct where the cuts go within Minsku. And particularly, of course, we would, this has been brought up before, some of the technology. We had 115% increase in technology spending. Frankly, we think a lot of that was really good. I mean, faculty support, new servers, new routers, new bandwidth, up-to-date software. But at a time when we're cutting budgets, we have... there's dozens of new initiatives that are being proposed. They could be implemented over a longer period of time. Frankly, it's more important to protect. 90% of our classes are still students sitting in front of a professor in a classroom. Those need to be protected. Even the online courses are taught by a professor at the campus level. We think it's important first to protect the campus budgets and then make sure that tuition remains affordable so students can afford to go. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Nelson.
Madam Chair, Rick Nelson from the Minnesota State College faculty. I could just echo by saying ditto to Mr. Stanton, my distinguished colleague from IFO. But I would like to say that the faculty on our campuses from 25 campuses and 53 communities across the state, thank you, members of this committee, the legislature, for the appropriation that you sent to our organization last year. I have never seen the excitement in the 7 years that I've followed the legislature among our faculty members. They were excited they weren't going to have to sit in budget cut meetings, sit in, create new initiatives with no money, do more with less. They now stepped to the table this past 11 months and said we can be creative. We can meet the needs of business and industry. We can meet the needs of students. We can prevent students from coming to you and talking about transfer issues because we can now offer more programs, more classes, and more opportunities. In the last 10 days, I can't tell you how many emails I've received from Worthington to International Falls talking about now what are we going to do? When just 2 weeks ago we heard about transfer, common course numbering, all those issues come back up. And we think they're a direct result of what has happened with past appropriations given to the Minsku system. Our two-year college faculty members are teachers. They were excited about the teaching and learning that was going to go on in the classroom. In fact, I had one faculty member that's nearing retirement who said in the 1960s, when Minnesota's economic outlook was bleak, leaders in your chairs stepped to the plate and created the two-year college system, expanded the technical college system, enhanced the University of Minnesota and the state university system. And we see the results of the 70s, 80s, and 90s because of this commitment. My question to you comes, do we treasure what we're doing in our colleges, universities, and the University of Minnesota across the state, or do we give it rhetoric? Our organization, again, wants to thank you, but then we want you to remember the decisions that you make affect the students, which alters the economy and affects the future, in which then causes students to complain to you that they didn't get their degree in a timely fashion and were put back on the stand to defend what we do. Remember, back in elementary school, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. The governor's proposed budget cuts will produce an equal
an opposite reaction for sure, but not one that's positive for the state of Minnesota. So Chair Pappas and members of this community and this committee, we encourage you to hold harmless our colleges and the university as you address the budget issue that you have in front of you. We thank you for your time, your energy, and your efforts, and we know you'll do the right thing.
Thank you very much, both of you, and as we go through these budget discussions, I think we need your prayers as well.
Thank you.
To come out of here. Thanks. Thank you very much, everyone. Senate File 786, I know Senator Skoy was in the room. There he is. He's back in the room. And if you want to bring up with you whoever you want to bring up, I don't know if you want to bring up Mr. Laird, Mr. Cronister.
Madam Chair, while the witnesses are coming up, thank you for giving me time hearing Senate File 786. I do have an amendment, the A2 amendment. The A2 amendment brings the bill in line with the resources that I believe potentially would be available in the state grant, and also makes a change for the University of Minnesota so that their cap would be on an average of tuition and fee maximum versus the current legislative cap.
Madam Chair, I would move the A2 amendment to get the shape into the bill into the shape that Senator Skoy would like it.
Senator Cohen moves the A2 amendment as an author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And Senate File 786 is a bill that reduces the student share, student responsibility in the state grant from 46 to 45. Originally, we had a larger percent change there, but we recognize the financial difficulties that we have and do ask for this small change. The student share is the part that many students end up borrowing. That's the portion that ends up at accumulated debt that they carry as they end up graduating, and I think as a state, it would be good for us to move toward reducing that. Section 2, as I stated earlier, is a effort to bring the University of Minnesota in line so that they don't bump up against the cap and the state grant, and their students will be able to access the state grant. I'm here with Mr. David Laird from the Minnesota Private Colleges and Stacia Smith, and they would like to provide some testimony on the bill.
Oh, in session. Okay. I'm sorry. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I'm David Laird, President of the Minnesota Private College Council, and I'm here representing our 17 member institutions and the 60,000 students that we educate per year. I understand your time limits and time concerns. I'll be very brief, but happy to respond to additional questions.
Okay.
The opportunity here today arises because for the first time in 6 years, Congress has been able to reach a bipartisan agreement on increasing the Pell Grants. It's taken 3 years to forge that consensus, and it comes on top of a five-year decline in the purchasing power of the combination of our state grant and the national Pell. For those of you who are new to this, beginning in 1983, the state policy shifted so that our state grant stands on the shoulders of the national Pell. And when the national Pell increases, that provides an opportunity for us to reinvest some additional resources in the state grant program, and that over the years, every time that opportunity has arisen, the legislature and the governor have agreed to that reinvestment process. Given our current economic conditions, given the likelihood that all students and all systems are going to experience tuition increases in the coming years, this is an ideal opportunity for you to target some additional resources to the people whose documented needs reflect the need for additional need-based aid. You may recall that in a report that was delivered earlier last fall, an outside expert observer from Pennsylvania estimated that in spite of the efforts of the legislature and a number of governors over the years, our state grant program right now runs about $200 million short of the actual need of the families of our students. I don't offer that as a complaint. That's just a reality that we must face. In addition, as a couple of the students referenced in their presentations, in 2005, Minnesota families and students borrowed in excess of $1 billion. That's not a level that we ought to salute or hope to continue. It is, in fact, unsustainable. And the present situation economically and in the banking and capital markets.
Mr. Laird, how much did you say?
Our families and students,
yes,
statewide, all systems, borrowed over $1 billion.
Oh, a billion. I thought you said a million. Oh, that makes more sense.
No.
Okay, a billion.
And that billion does not include what we can't track in terms of families borrowing against home equity,
right,
and it doesn't track credit card debt. So this is an opportunity, as Senator Scoy has indicated, to help those students and families borrow less, and someday we're going to have a long discussion about how we divert some of our current borrowing to other means of paying those costs. Please don't forget, as you consider this, that there are currently 80,000 students in the state grant program. They are proportionally divided among the various institutions and systems that they attend. Currently, in this year, 39% of the recipients attend MNSCU institutions, 21% attend the University of Minnesota, 21% attend the private college group that we represent, 14% come from the for-profits, and there's an additional 5% in other types of institutions. We encourage you to consider this as another step in a long history of legislative support for this program and an opportunity that's not likely to come around very often.
Thank you very much. And members, next week we're going to look again at what the governor has proposed in terms of the state grant and see if any other members have any other ideas. Mr. Albrecht tells me that to reduce the student share 1% would cost $7.25 million, and to raise the four-year cap, tuition cap, would cost $5.5 million. Senator Scoy.
Yes, Madam Chair, I think that's right. Actually, in the discussions that we've had, we think that with the economy turning south, there will be increased pressures on the state grant program because additional students will be entering the systems, and it would be wise to leave a little funds for that.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Smith.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Stacia Smith. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Chamber is the state's largest business advocacy organization with over 2,700 members, and I would like to speak in support of this bill. The Minnesota Chamber has historically supported the state grant as it allows students to take dollars to whatever institution fits their needs best, and we feel that these Pell dollars should continue to stay in the state grant program. And I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions from members of the committee?
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Just a quick question. What is the lowest percent of student responsibility that we've ever had?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling,
this is it?
46.
46.
So started out at 50.
Okay.
Started out at 50, and there was nothing magic about that. It fit the formula at the time and the resources at hand.
So, Madam Chair, this would be the lowest.
Yeah.
Dropping down to 45 now.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scoy.
But, Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, I'd like you to keep in mind that earlier in the years, the state did commit a significant larger portion of the cost of education than it currently is, and now it's currently a much higher percentage falling to the student to fund through this type of program. And I would draw your attention to the editorial in today's Star Tribune about needed strategies for more college grads. The state grant program is one of the strategies that we have, but you have extremely challenging job in front of you as you work to fill the deficit of up to 10,000 graduates that the state is going to be facing in the future. And I listened to what Senator Lynch said earlier, and I certainly do support her ideas and thoughts on that.
Thank you. Ms. Brockett, did you still want to testify?
No.
Sit here.
Oh, great.
Hi, my name is Kara Brockett. I'm the chair of the Minnesota State University Student Association, and I would just like to briefly talk. Our student association would really like to see the money in the state grant formula, or the state grant, the surplus being used for living in miscellaneous expenses rather than any of the other programs. We feel that this is the most fair way to distribute the surplus to students who need it at all institutions, be it public or private. And we would also like to see some money left over for what a previous speaker said, the potential and probable increase of students in the coming years with the recession. So we currently oppose this bill. Okay. I'm open for any questions.
Okay, thank you very much. Then Senate File 786 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the higher ed finance bill.
Thank you very much, Senator Squire. Madam Chair and members.
Senator Wieger. Senator Wieger, thank you for coming before us with the K-12 policy bill. Kind of in our, we're finding in our P-16, P-20 discussions that we have overlap between the two divisions, and we've had some joint hearings together, and now we're going to look at only the provisions in your bill that have to do with the Board of Teaching, because we are responsible for the higher ed portion of that. So does Senator Wieger have the handout? Why don't you make sure you give him one so he can just, if he hasn't seen it already. Oh, we are? Yep, it's first. Right. Okay.
Madam Chair, this is just a copy from the second engrossment?
Yes. Okay. Just the sections we're looking at.
And as that's being distributed, Madam Chair, I'll just note that in Article 2, Section 1, we do restate the data sharing, which is also in your committee's omnibus bill, but it's here as well as it's an exchange of information between K-12 and higher ed. And on the provision that is being distributed, we have devoted a great deal of discussion through subcommittee on reading instruction. Senator Saltzman and Senator Olson, Jen, they have co-chaired a subcommittee that has developed the recommendations here. And I believe there's people that did want to testify. To get to the heart of the matter, it has to do with requirements expected in higher ed. And when we talk about literacy proficiency by students, it ultimately gets into a discussion on preparation of teachers. And you actually have a bill addressing rigor as well in higher ed. There are people here to testify, I believe, on that provision, and I don't know if Senator Saltzman and Senator
Saltzman Olson is here, and
here, but if you'd like them to offer comments or perhaps you want to entertain testimony. Well,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Saltzman told me that she does have an amendment, so maybe it would be a good idea for her to present her amendment, and then when people testify, you know, I did ask some people to testify in general about reading research. Is Mr. O'Brien here? Yeah.
Madam Chair, that's an excellent idea.
I don't know if he – are you – Mr. O'Brien, are you going to comment on the bill, or are you just going to talk about reading strategies in research in general?
Both.
Okay. Well, so why don't we hear what
Madam Chair, but perhaps if we do have an amendment that may have helped facilitate an agreement, it could narrow the focus of the discussion.
That's what I thought.
And so I'd like to introduce my colleagues and – if someone would like to offer the A-20 amendment.
Do we have your amendment, Senator Saltzman?
It's the A-20 amendment. I'm not sure if you have it or not, Madam Chair. I'll give it to you, John.
Does Anne Marie have it? We have it. Okay.
Madam Chair, I would move that if you want.
Doug's forgetting. Maybe
we should see it.
Why don't we, you can move the bill to have it before us, but before we vote, because it's not considered an author's amendment, why don't we have it explained?
Okay. And thank you, Madam Chair, and members of this committee. Just a little background about this particular initiative. We have a lot of stories to tell of children who are struggling to read, and we've heard disturbing stories about test scores and reading proficiencies. So I'm not here representing a lot of organizations. I'm here, as I believe Senator Olson is, representing the 60% of children who struggle to read in this state. We have heard stories of teachers being retrained. We've heard stories from Central Minnesota of 60 school districts coming together to form a literacy collaborative, spending $1 million a year to go to Ohio State because they failed to develop a relationship with any of our own higher education institutions. We hear of school districts that are looking at developing online staff development programs out of Texas, again, because they feel their needs have not been addressed here. So we're really talking about, as we talk about the achievement gap, we've really held our school districts' feet to the fire. We look at test scores, we talk about parents, we talk about teachers, and we need to make sure that higher education is also at the table because they prepare our teachers. So this is not anything of pointing fingers of blame or anything else. It's essentially saying that when it comes to making sure that our children can read and we hear about effective teaching strategies that work, we're just wondering why these programs are not being instituted within our pre-service teacher programs. And we know we have wonderful colleges in this state. We know we have wonderful research institutions. We hear a lot from them in our testimony about what works. And what we're asking now is that we want accountability to make sure that young teachers coming out of college are not going to be the experts in reading, but to be able to have the basic skills that we hear repeatedly are working with our struggling readers. We are not advocating for a specific curriculum. We're not trying to limit. We're not trying to substitute. We're actually trying to do just the opposite, and that's what's been most frustrating about some of the emails we've got, is that we're trying to, you know, specify a specific reading practice. We're actually doing the opposite. We're saying, let's make sure teachers have every tool in their tool belt. So as opposed to saying that we are limiting, we're trying to, you know, specifically broaden. And you hear a lot of testimony from us. You've heard a lot of discussion in our work group about phonics and also phonemic awareness. And we're not advocating only for those teaching strategies, but we believe that those are the two components that too often are missing. And the stories we've heard from parents who have money and means to go out and help their children read is that these are two specific components that they did not find in their public schools. And we are very impressed with those parents because some of them have said that money and luck should not determine if a child is able to read. And for the children who don't have money and luck, or maybe don't have parents who can take them to a tutor, why would we not want these strategies to be in our public schools? We are not saying that there should not be staff development. We applaud school districts. And this particular amendment, what it will do is that it will take away the language that will require the tests for relicensure of teachers. We want to make a point that all of our teachers should have these skills, not just our pre-service. So we are striking the language that would require relicensure of teachers starting in 2013 to pass this specific test. We are also striking some language that would define the test as a test that has been implemented within a state for 5 years. So we are still being fairly prescriptive in the test. Our bottom line is that we have had language within statute prescribing these effective reading strategies beginning in, I believe, the year 2000. And over the past 6 to 7 years, this this body has, you know, further, you know, promoted that those reading strategies. They are the five strands, they're the five big ideas for reading. They come from the National Reading Panel after over 100,000 pieces of literature were reviewed. And what we're saying is that we've had 8 years to make sure that these specific strategies are in place and being taught. And now we're hearing that, you know, there is a process in place to review our reading standards. We applaud that effort, but by the time it's in place, it's going to take about 10 years. That's almost a whole generation of school children. And we just can't afford that because we hear repeatedly about the achievement gap. So this is not an effort for us to pretend that we're reading experts, but we do hear the stories of children who struggle to read, and that's why we're here today. So that is the amendment, essentially. At this point.
Welcome, Senator Olson.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. It'd be hard to improve at all on what Senator Saltzman has said. I would let you act on the amendment, and if you have questions or if there's further testimony, I'll be happy to respond as well.
Senator Saltzman, would you point out on the amendment? You kind of talked in general what you were doing with it. Would you point out the lines and tell us what you're doing?
If I can look at the original bill. So on line 40.
On page 40.
Page 40. On page 40, line 1, you would delete the new underlined language and, where applicable, the reading instruction competence assessment.
And that is for new teachers?
And that is for continuing licenses.
That's for continuing licenses.
Okay,
licensure.
So we're striking that. And then
the effective date?
Effective date. The effective date language that refers to that particular line is also struck. That would make it effective in 2013. So it does keep a test for pre-service teachers in place, effective July 1st, 2010.
And then we also
strike on line 41, administered. We essentially strike the language that references a test that has been administered in another state for over 5 years and be composed of multiple choice and constructive response questions. We are deleting that. There was some testimony in the House on Friday by a University of Minnesota professor that stated that this particular test in Massachusetts is in trouble. We spoke to the Massachusetts Department this morning, and this test is not in trouble. There is another communications and literacy test that is taken by all teachers, and that test is being reviewed. Mm-hmm. But this particular test has been very effective for them, and in some committees you may have heard some reference from Massachusetts about the good results that they're having in reading. And we are not saying that a test in itself causes teachers to be better teachers, but a test such as this clearly sets the bar for the knowledge that we expect should be required of new teachers.
And Madam Chair, if I might add,
yes, Senator Olson,
a bit to that. I think what we envision in using the test and using it early is giving it an opportunity for prospective teachers, as well as even available to current teachers, to self-assess and see where they are in relation to the five strands of reading that we have had, research-based reading instruction, that have been in our statutes for a number of years. This particular test is based on the National Reading Panel's research, and so that's why it's very consistent with what our statute in terms of policy has directed both the Board of Teaching and our teacher ed institutions to implement. And so it gives an opportunity to see where we're at and then be able to look at course correction, if we will, mm-hmm. to assure that our teachers are going into the classrooms well prepared to deal with the whole range of students that they will need to teach. And we know that there are struggling readers. I've had from emails saying, well, some of the things that we're doing and describe them are serving most students. Well, most is not a standard that we're being allowed to implement. It's every student. Reading is so essential all the way along the line. In your committee, you're dealing with the higher ed, the demands, the importance, not just of cost, but of students being prepared to take on challenging subject matter at the higher ed level. It follows all the way through. If you don't have a good foundation in reading, you are handicapped for the rest of your life. And we feel that it's extremely important that that happen before third grade, and that's why we are putting we want to add this added impetus to assuring that that our teachers are well equipped to do that so that they can have the satisfaction
yes.
of success.
Senator Saltzman, on line of the amendment 1-8 and 1-9, you're deleting a date, but you're leaving a blank.
Yes,
and
really. Mm-hmm.
It's actually not, those things are not really in our jurisdiction. They have to do with the Commissioner of Education. And I don't really know if we should muck around with the date in this committee.
Okay,
could you take care of that in finance?
Certainly, yes,
we
certainly can.
Dates.
And I do want to add that this does not have to be a standalone test, that we are just very, very emphatic that we absolutely need to make sure that our teachers are being tested. Right now, the Praxis test, it's my understanding that about 30% of it tests for reading, and of that 30%, 25 has to do specifically with reading, or excuse me, language arts, and then of the 30%, 25% has to do with reading. So it's 10 out of 120 questions, and that a person applying for licensure could miss all of those questions and still pass the test. So the current test regarding reading certainly needs to be redone. And as that test is redone, we would like to have an expectation that it clearly addresses the Minnesota Statute 122A.06, which talks about these five strands. And
Senator Saltzman, please, mm-hmm. let me just interrupt you
right.
for a moment, because I'd just like to follow a little bit clearer, more orderly process. Senator Coring was going to move your amendment. He's not here. Senator Clark will move the A20 amendment, but only line 1.1 through 1.7. And then you can take care of the dates.
Thank you.
Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Now, Senator Saltzman, if you could just tell us, you know, assuming we've incorporated this amendment, what just take it section by section. What are you trying to accomplish with Section 19?
Section 19. I'm going to look for the bill, Madam Chair, just a second. Thank you so much.
Are these your five strands that you were talking about?
Yes. These are the five strands, and we do very little to change existing language in here, although we do add very specific definitions, and we believe that makes it more clear to everyone what we're talking about, what we're referencing. And these definitions are taken from the National Reading Panel's definition of the five strands, so that when you talk about phonics, what exactly do we mean by that? What do we need, mean by vocabulary development and reading comprehension?
Are there any questions on Section 19? Okay, then Section 23.
Section 23 references that that in order to successfully complete, we've added language that in order for a person to receive an initial teaching license, that they must require the board to successfully complete a reading assessment that is consistent with Subdivision 2C, which refers to the test, the assessment. They'll be described later on. That must be done before they are granted an initial teaching licensure.
So that's the test in addition to the Praxis mm-hmm. test.
Or that they need to be assessed in this area.
In this area.
Right.
So it could be added to the Praxis
test. It could be added to a test of reading, math, and writing as
and
well.
Section 24?
Section 24, I believe that this says that currently that teacher colleges have to enable the licensure candidate to know how to teach reading in the candidate's content area and prepare the licensure candidate to pass the Minnesota
assessment.
Reading Instruction Competence Assessment so that that material is covered as well.
And then Section 25,
in
sub 2C
section
we discussed.
25.
Describing what the assessment
this,
is.
This describes the assessment, correct.
Okay.
And we've made some changes to that.
Section 58.
Section 58 This charges the Commissioner of Education to adopt a reading instruction competence assessment, to report to the House and Senate, the Education Policy Committees on the assessment that has been adopted.
I do have a question about this section that it's before us. Is why is the Commissioner of Education adopting this assessment and not the Board of Teaching?
We felt that we wanted the Commissioner to be involved with this because we put forward a proposal here to sort of jumpstart this, in that we knew that we could not expect the higher ed institutes and teacher colleges to have a test imposed on them this coming fall and then be able to include this in their curriculum. And so by having the test out there for 2 years, that then the candidates could take this test and it could sort of be a baseline for where our teacher candidates are. One of the things that we heard about in Massachusetts was that when students were taking their comprehensive achievement tests, that they allowed them to take them for 2 years without really scoring them or else publishing them because it gave people feedback. And so this is a way for us to jumpstart. The other thing that we heard about that's in this is a scholarship program is that, again, we've heard from a number of school districts that they're accessing training for their teachers through non-traditional higher education institutions, going to workshops, leaving the state. We do have programs here in Minnesota where our teachers are becoming trained in this. So if these are not the programs that our school districts are always accessing, we put together a proposal that students within our higher ed and our teaching colleges could access these as well through a scholarship program made up of both public and private money. It's sort of an out there idea. It certainly has caused a lot of discussion, but I think it raises the point that where are teachers getting trained in these most effective strategies? And it's not necessarily within our pre-service programs. We're also hearing that some of these practices are being taught, but they're being taught within graduate programs or being taught as part of special education curriculum. And we would argue that if we can get to these kids younger, if we have teachers within our general classrooms who are apprised of these, know how to use these strategies and assess children, we'll be reducing the number of kids who are inappropriately placed in special ed because we didn't intervene earlier. So we're really pushing this to make a statement that this is where a lot of our school districts are going to train their teachers. So is this perhaps where our college students should also have access to these kind of programs? Are these alternative programs?
I know you spent a lot of time on this in Senator Wieger's committee and your subcommittee, and we have much more limited time. So, Senator Olson, can you make a brief comment, and then I'd like to bring up the testifiers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you can see, this has been a work in progress, and we are continuing to work on that. And as Senator Saltzman talked about, the assessment going for a couple of years and providing information that would allow for establishing cut scores before, in fact, it is put in actual place. I think we would envision that the Board of Teaching probably would be the one to handle the setting of the cut scores. And there have been comments made that with the proposed changes in rules that we'll be coming and putting in place, whether this assessment is consistent with our own rules, I think this will give a basis for evaluation and seeing how this might have to be adapted, or if it does need to be adapted to the rules that are being put in place to achieve the very same thing.
Okay. Thank you very much. Then Ms. Cindy Chris from Minscu, she's going to give us a little update on some of the reading research in Minscu. Great.
They'll come up now, but be available.
Thanks. Do you want to stay at the three of you want to stay at the table and then while the witnesses come up or
stay here?
All right. That's great. Yeah, sit right there.
Thank
Welcome
you, Senator
back.
Pappas. I had hoped to have a faculty member. My name is Cindy Chris, Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. I'd hoped to have a faculty member from one of our state universities that prepares elementary teachers here today, but the combination of spring break schedules, weather, and those pesky teaching schedules that keep our faculty in classrooms conspired against me. So I have just a few brief points to make based on consultation with our institutions and a review of the bill. And I'll make those points very briefly, and I have some backup information should you want to hear it, but I'm guessing in the interest of time you won't. So five brief points. First of all, the Minnesota State Colleges and University System is committed to ensuring that the teachers who complete teacher licensure programs at our state universities are well prepared to begin practice in the area of reading. Reading is the area in which at all six of our state universities that offer elementary ed, Metro State does not yet offer it. They have more courses in reading and language arts preparation than in preparation to teach any other discipline. I could read you some course descriptions at some point if that would be helpful. But know that they're rigorous, and everything that our state universities teach is research-based. Secondly, we're concerned about the proposed addition of a reading test as specified in this language, and our concerns are based on several things. First of all, my understanding, I can claim no particular expertise here, but talking to our folks that have it, tell me that the proposed test is not sufficiently broad and comprehensive in its focus to measure all of the skills and knowledge needed to effectively teach reading. This may be fixed by the change in the bill brought forward today, I'm not certain. The narrowness of the proposed test and of reading methods and strategies addressed in the bill seem likely to disadvantage or neglect to sufficiently serve the broad range of students in our classrooms. The process set forth for identifying a reading test and setting a passing score is inconsistent with that used for all other teacher licensure-related testing, which is managed by the Board of Teaching. And requiring an additional test for all individuals seeking K-6 licensure would increase student costs with no evidence of sufficient impact to justify that cost. Currently, you might want to know that students who graduate from K-6 with K-6 programs in a 5-8 specialty currently pay $465 for the tests and registration fees for the currently required tests. Third brief point is that we really urge those concerned about teacher quality, and I think that's all of us in this room, to recognize teacher development as a career-long continuum that does not end when a teacher achieves initial licensure. Beginning licensure simply assures that a teacher is ready to begin practice. If you looked over the requirements for elementary teachers, as I've just been reminded of in the last 2 days, I'm not sure what you would cut out, and yet how you could expect more expertise when we currently expect them to teach every discipline. Many teaching strategies and skills are best gained in the classroom. I can attest to that from my 10 years as an elementary special ed teacher. Although clinical experiences within pre-service programs are an essential piece of teacher development, much professional learning only occurs after a teacher has become the teacher of record in his or her classroom. I have other points I could make there, but I know you want to move on, so I'll just say that in light of all of this, I think that learning that young teachers have gained reading-related skills and knowledge through professional development is evidence that this continuum is in place and is working, not that higher education has somehow failed to prepare those teachers for initial licensure. Fourth, it's totally unclear to me, and I've tried to follow this bill, what the idea of is behind the proposal to establish approved reading instruction program centers and approved reading instruction programs when we already have an array of public and private colleges, universities in the state approved to provide licensure. Given the number of approved licensure programs, I don't know what this would accomplish. And then finally, I'd just like to say that I've been following the work of the current reading task force created by the Board of Teaching. They're focusing on critical issues in teacher preparation and licensure, engaging some of the best minds in our state in this area, and I believe they should be allowed to complete their work. They've operated in an inclusive way, and while their emerging recommendations, as I understand it, don't have unanimous support in the group, they do have the support of the majority of the members of the task force.
Thank you very much. What I was really kind of hoping to get, and I'm sorry the short notice, is I really wanted to know, does MNSCU do research into reading strategies and have specific instructors who could come in and talk about what the research is they've done, or is that something that's mostly left to the University of Minnesota? Because there is, even if it's just anecdotal, we need to get to the bottom of this, that this frustration that a lot of us have is that our teachers don't know how to teach
They don't have enough strategies in their toolbox to be able to teach reading to a variety of kids. And so that's kind of, it's not just Senator Saltzman and Senator Olson. You know, we've been talking about this reading issue for a long, long time. And we still hear from our schools that are hiring teachers that they're not able to teach reading. And that seems kind of like a basic thing. And maybe there is something else that the Board of Teaching requires that needs to drop. Maybe we need to have teachers that are K-3 and teachers that are 4-6 so that the K-3 teachers can focus more on reading. It's a problem with the achievement gap. If students don't learn to read, then, you know, they can't learn other things as well. So this is a sincere effort, and we really would like the Minsku teaching institutions to work with us on this, we'd like to know, you said that all your institutions teach research-based strategies, and that's not the information we get. And so I'd also like to know, what are the research-based strategies? Are they up to date with all those strategies? Are the faculty then changing their curriculum to respond to any new research that's being done? So that's kind of the message to send back, and I'm glad the MACD, Ms. Bent, Professor Bent is also in the room, and we're going to call her up in a minute. Senator Lynch, did you have a question?
Just a comment, Madam Chair, and that is that the work that Senator Saltzman and Senator Olson have brought forth is really the result of Senator Wigger taking the Ed Policy Committee across the state during the interim. I would have to struggle to find a district that we visited that did not bring this matter to our attention in one form or another. And what they're bringing to us today is much, much more than staff development. Staff development is a critical component, absolutely. But what they're bringing forward is something much larger than staff development and really seeks to address, frankly, a gap that we have. And sometimes it's difficult to acknowledge that and to recognize that, but we cannot afford not to. And so I would just echo Senator Pappas' comments that we need our public institutions to step forward on this in a large way.
And I think maybe we should have brought this up with the chancellor when he was here. I was tempted to bring up the electrician issue with the chancellor.
Madam Chair and Senator Lynch, can I just briefly respond? We do have faculty who do research, deep research into reading, mm-hmm. and I don't know if there'll be time this session to get them before you, but we certainly could identify them. I would also say that
they should be before the reading subcommittee of the K-12 committee talking about their research. I don't know if they have been or not, but that would be, you know, the appropriate place. And are they disseminating then their successful outcomes to the other campuses?
Madam Chair, I think there's a great deal of sharing that's going on. I'm not sure exactly where the gap is between what was heard in the hearings and what I hear. I talk to my colleagues in K-12 regularly. That's part of my job. I've talked to the elementary school principals. They have not identified this to me as a major problem. Beyond the normal context of we all need to keep working on what we're doing and doing it better, we have teachers who are trying to reach an increasingly diverse group of students with more and more, bringing more and more different languages to them. I think you can see that reflected in many of the courses that we teach. You know, are our folks doing a perfect job? Absolutely not. Are they always trying to do better? Yes, they are. Are they doing the research and working to share it? Yes, they are. And I think you'll perhaps hear more of those details from my colleagues from the University of Minnesota.
Okay. All right, thank you very much. To be continued. I'd like to ask Professor O'Brien and Professor Bentz to come up. Senator Olson, maybe we could help pull up another chair if you want to still stay here. And I asked you to come here, and I really apologize now that we're so pressed for time because we really do want to get your input. Professor O'Brien.
Chair Pappas, members of the committee. I think my voice is big. I'm David O'Brien. I'm a faculty member in curriculum and instruction in the College of Education and Human Development. One of my primary
to?
Oh, at the University of Minnesota? That part was clear. At the University of Minnesota, one of my primary goals is to conduct and study research on strategies implementation, assessments of strategies used not only for kids developing as readers, but also the focus on reading as it is needed as a learning tool across the disciplines. All of my colleagues are researchers. I would say that all of the colleagues who are in the literacy program in the area of reading are nationally recognized researchers in reading. I don't know if members of the committee or other people in the room know this, but when you look at the University of Minnesota and you look historic, at least back into the 50s, there are more people, and this is currently the case, across departments and centers in the College of Education that do research in reading than anywhere else in the country. This is a cross-disciplinary effort, so we have a lot of people who do research. I wanted to comment specifically on this, you know, things that people have been hearing about comprehensive, scientifically based reading strategies. And I would like to say that the National Reading Panel report is something that we all take very seriously. And we take it seriously because some of my colleagues are either have been members of the National Reading Panel, Jay Samuels was on that panel, have contributed primary studies that are part of the syntheses of research that are that are reported in the subgroup reports of the panel. And we are very thrilled that the National Reading Panel was able to synthesize such a huge body of research that we can all use and that we implement in our coursework. And I would like to say, you know, that I've heard the arguments, and I've actually seen the video of previous testimony, and I think that it's very well intentioned, and I think that Senators Saltzman and Olson are to be commended for the way that they've responded to the parents who have had these concerns about their kids. And I'll say that when I saw the video, it was heart-wrenching to see kids that said, you know, I needed help and my teacher couldn't help me. So first of all, I want to say that as reading researchers, we are also very experienced teachers, that myself and most of my colleagues have teaching experience that spans elementary, middle, and secondary school. At the national level, I've worked with the Council of Great City Schools, and some of you know of that council. It's a council that represents the interests of the largest urban districts and, in fact, the largest 66 school districts in the country. And one of the things that we've worked to address is the achievement gap, specifically in the area of reading. I have been an invited speaker to that organization for the last 2 years to speak specifically on that issue. All of that work is connected back to the way we prepare teachers. And so when I think about a test, there is no research to support the connection between another test and improvement in reading instruction in kids in Minnesota. There is a lot of reason for us to all be concerned that anybody is hearing from parents or caregivers or teachers or administrators that people are graduating from teacher education programs not prepared to teach reading. We do a comprehensive survey of our graduates, and Mary can talk about that, that indicates the opposite of that, that our graduates feel prepared to teach reading, although they recognize that it's a very complex thing. We are open, and I'm here to say that as I've heard, as I've read the legislation, I've heard the testimony from the various groups that we're here to collaborate, and I think that what we need is collaboration, not legislation, that specifically describes what are the five areas and descriptions of the different components that we need to learn more about. We know what they are. At least in our program, we're very much aware of what they are. We're very much aware of how to implement them in our courses. And we assess our students on these, not only on tests and quizzes in their coursework, but on multiple practica in the field with multiple observers from the university, multiple supervising teachers out in the school system. So. And I don't hear that they from them that they feel like they're underprepared. That actually surprises me a lot. So I just want to say that we're here to offer whatever resources we have from the University of Minnesota in terms of our contributed time to outreach to continue to work on this. And as it's been stated before, there is a great working document developed by the Board of Teaching. They shared a draft of it with me. And it is not only one of the most comprehensive documents I've seen in states that I've worked with, and I've worked with a number of states around the country on these issues. It represents the views of a lot of professionals who are among the most knowledgeable people that I know in the state of Minnesota. So I'm hoping that we can continue that work and even get more people on board to work with that document and to invest in about a year's work that's already gone into it. And I think it's headed in the right direction. But I'll say, from my perspective, I'm very concerned that I'm hearing that we're graduating people from our institutions who are not prepared to teach reading. But it sort of surprises me to hear this. Okay.
And Dr. Bentz?
Thank you, Chair Pappas. I had some notes that I'm just discarding, and so that I can comment on some of the things that I've heard here today, including the amendments. I am Mary Bentz. I'm the Associate Dean in the College of Education and Human Development at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. I am here today, though, as the representative of MACTE, which is the Minnesota Association of Colleges for Teacher Education. All of the institutions in Minnesota that have been approved by the Board of Teaching are members of this organization, and so we are an organization of institutional members. I came here today to comment on the impact on both students as well as institutions of the legislation in general, but what I would really like to say is that the organization is very much in support of working with and through the organization that is already in place in the state, that is the Board of Teaching. And the Reading Task Force, to which Dr. O'Brien referred, is a very important one, and it is a demonstration of how institutions have come together and worked across institutions. Faculty members from many institutions are represented on this task force, as well as teachers, administrators, and others. You may want to talk more with the folks who are from the Board of Teaching related to the work of that task force, but it is the way that colleges and teacher preparation institutions have regulated what we have done, what we are prepared to do. The standards that they are looking at are certainly taken from the standards, a lot of the standards that are here in this legislation. And I think that we have to recognize the amount of time that it takes to implement that is not, 10 years, it won't take that long to implement. In fact, the colleagues that to which Dr. O'Brien referred and folks who are working within the MACTE organization work together to continue to implement and change what we're doing and improve and use the most current research to work in our schools or to work in our courses and to be preparing our teachers. So there are lots of more things that I could talk about here. One of the things that was related earlier to me was that we don't spend very much time in our preparation programs with reading and with literacy. Actually, about 20 to 30% of the time that we spend with our students works on this particular area. We all know how important that is for learning in all areas, not just in reading, but in learning science and math and every other content area. So this is a focus, and it is an important thing that all of the institutions are focused on. The MACTE organization, in fact, spends a couple of times a year bringing faculty members together. It is a way that we update one another and learn across institutional lines about issues and about research and about things that we should be doing and improving our programs. So I would offer that the process that the Board of Teaching has already in place and is using and is working with institutions to improve their programs, that remain the place that we look to make any changes in our standards.
Thank you very much. I need to just set this aside for just a second. I need to make a technical motion. I'd like Senator Sharon moves. Members, this is our omnibus education policy bill that needs to go to finance for a variety of reasons, which you can talk to the staff about because I can't remember why. So Senator Sharon moves that Senate File Number 2942 is amended and previously moved and approved for referral to the floor instead be moved for recommendation for passage as amended and transmitted to the Finance Committee by the Higher Education Finance Division. Okay, so we're going to send it to finance
motion.
Instead of the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Well, I think this topic we have not had enough time to spend on. And my recommendation is that we do send Senator Wieger's bill to finance. It'll go to, and Senator Stump's committee will have to struggle with this as to what's the right thing to do. And I just would hope that Senator Saltzman and Senator Olson continue to talk to the stakeholders and that we all share the same concern that we want our children to learn to read. I know. We want our children to learn to read. And what is the best approach? What is the best way to assess that? What is the best way to make sure that all our teacher ed institutions are teaching students the latest research-based strategies? I mean, this is something I think that we're all struggling with. We don't really have time to look at the other sections of the bill, which I did have the staff look at, and they've been passed out. And if members have any quick questions for Senator Wieger, we can certainly do that. Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, thank you. I just want to comment on this provision one more, just a bit more, because I feel like the testimony today was largely centered around the Board of Teaching, and I don't believe that Senator Saltzman or Senator Olson's bill was about the Board of Teaching. What I really think that the legislation is about is really a reality check. And we're just here because the reality is that across Minnesota in our public schools, we need to do business differently. We need to do business differently. And we know that by the end of second grade, if our students aren't reading at grade level, it becomes exponentially difficult to get them to that point. And the legislation that they're bringing forward is not about a test any more than it's about the Board of Teaching. It is about the fact that when we go to school districts and visit, principals and teachers and parents across the state tell us that there are students that are struggling. And this is not a new phenomena. And our teachers are being sent either to staff development or to, workshops or out of state to augment the training that they're already getting. And we're trying to suggest that we want our teachers prepared, well-versed, and ready to go. And we're asking, and we need support across the spectrum.
Thank you, Senator Lynch.
I'd like to thank you all very much. If Senator Wieger would just stay there for a minute, I want to pass the gavel to Senator Sharon to chair the meeting for a minute. And I'd like to offer the A-19 amendment, which is being passed out right now. Members, this is the Responsible Family Life and Sexuality Education Bill, which the full Senate has passed twice. The only difference in this bill is that it doesn't include the optional sections for elementary students. It's just the 7 through 12. Otherwise, it's pretty much the same that we passed off the Senate floor. Senator, this was intended to be in Senator Wieger's bill, and I would like to move the A-19 amendment.
Okay, Senator Pappas moves the A-19 amendment.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
And I don't know that I object to it. I'm wondering about this being the right place to put it in, because if it's going to E-12 budget yet, I guess that's an area that deals more with this level of education instead of our division for higher ed.
Senator Roebling, it is a little unusual, but because we've passed this before in the Senate and I had a misunderstanding with Senator Wieger about what was happening with the bill. He thought I was going to offer a floor amendment, and I just think it's better that we have the K-12 budget division have a chance to look at it.
Okay, so Senator Pappas offers the A-19 amendment. Any further discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Senator Wieger, it's your bill. Is this what your intention was?
Senator
Madam Chair, Senator yes. Roblin, the spirit of this section has passed at least two or three times, I believe, before. And I believe, Senator Pappas, just scheduling-wise, it wasn't able to work for a hearing, but we have passed this before, and I do not object to it going in now, and it could be discussed.